Those who are serious about liberation are certainly non-envious, and they respect all. Yet they reject the horrible and ghastly forms of the demigods and worship only the all blissful forms of Lord Vishnu and his primary portions. Listen carefully in the purport. The concluding sentence says what the subject is, so it is for this reason that the candidates for liberation deliberately reject the worship of the demigods, although they have no disrespect for any one of them. So this is our graduate study of the message of Bhagavad Gita, why not worshiping the demigods, and why only worshiping Lord Vishnu, and how to properly regard the demigods, but how the worship goes only to the personality of God. So listen carefully. This is useful when you have to explain this to others. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who is the original person of the Vishnu categories, expands himself in two different categories, namely integrated plenary portions and separated parts and parcels. The Vishnu Tattva and Jiva Tattva. The separated parts and parcels are the servitors, and the integrated plenary portions of Vishnu Tattva are the worshipful objects of service. And he makes a new paragraph in that point. All demigods who are empowered by the Supreme Lord are also separated parts and parcels. They do not belong to the categories of Vishnu Tattva. The Vishnu Tattvas are living beings equally as powerful as the original form of the Personality of Godhead, and they display different categories of power in consideration of different times and circumstances. The separated parts and parcels are powerful by limitation. Nice way to say it. Very nice way to say it. Powerful by limitation. They do not have unlimited power, like the Vishnu Tattvas. Therefore, one should never classify the Vishnu Tattvas or the plenary portions of Narayan, the Personality of Godhead, in the same categories with the parts and parcels. If anyone does so, he becomes at once an offender by the name Pashandi. In the age of Kali, many foolish persons commit such unlawful offenses and equalize the two categories. Paragraph. The separated parts and parcels have different positions in the estimation of material powers. And some of them are like Kala Bhairava, Shmashana Bhairava, Shani, Mahakali, and Chandika. These demigods are worshipped mostly by those who are in the lowest categories of the mode of darkness or ignorance. Other demigods like Brahma, Shiva, Surya, Ganesh, and many similar deities are worshipped by men in the mode of passion, urged by the desire for material enjoyment, But those who are actually situated in the mode of goodness, sattva-guna, of material nature, worship only Vishnu tattvas. Vishnu tattvas are represented by various names and forms such as Narayana, Damodar, Vamana, Govinda, and Adhokshaja. And then one sentence stands on its own as its separate paragraph. The qualified Brahmanas worship the Vishnu tattvas represented by the Shalagram Shila and some of the higher castes like Kshatriyas and Vaishyas also generally worship the Vishnu tattvas. New paragraph. Highly qualified Brahmanas situated in the mode of goodness have no grudges against the mode of worship of others. They have all respect for other demigods, even though they may look ghastly, like Kala Bhairava or Mahakali. They know very well that these horrible features of the Supreme Lord are all different servitors of the Lord under different conditions. Yet they reject the worship of both horrible and attractive features of the demigods, and they concentrate only on the forms of Vishnu. Because they are serious about liberation from the material conditions. The demigods, even up to the stage of Brahma, the supreme of all the demigods, cannot offer liberation to anyone. Example this. Hiranyakashipu underwent a severe type of penance to become eternal in life, but his worshipful deity, Brahma, could not satisfy him with such blessings. Therefore, Vishnu and none else is called Muktipada, or the personality of Godhead who can bestow upon us mukti or liberation. The demigods, being like other living entities in the material world, are all liquidated at the time of the annihilation of the material structure. They are themselves unable to get liberation, and what to speak of giving liberation to their devotees. The demigods can award the worshippers some temporary benefit only, and not the ultimate one. Final statement, separate paragraph. It is for this reason only that candidates for liberation deliberately reject the worship of the demigods, although they have no disrespect for any one of them. We discussed yesterday this chapter 2, one of the strongest messages in the chapter is describing the sequential stages of the process of bhakti. And in that process of bhakti comes the removal of abhadras, unwanted things, the awakening of the higher modes of nature, the diminishing of the lower modes of nature, becoming situated in goodness, and then becoming situated in transcendental goodness, or Shuddha Sattva. Whereas this verse is saying, Sattvam Vishuddham Kshemaya. Kshemaya is delivering the ultimate benefit in that Vishuddha Sattva position. So that the process of devotional service does that, And so now there's these series of verses that are delineating what devotional service isn't. This idea of what's inclusive and what's exclusive. You've heard that description before. A good definition, when you're describing what a thing is, you give the details of what that thing is. For further clarification, you make sure people know what that thing isn't. You want a vridanga, it has two ends and it's shaped this way, and it's not one of those, and it's not one of those, and it's what it is, and it's what it is. So inclusive and exclusive. So this is the exclusive section. It's also, I mentioned this yesterday, but it's a bridge verse into the next chapter. Chapter 3 is delineation of the incarnations of the Lord. So the incarnations of the Lord are in the various varieties, including the guna avatars. In the guna avatars, they're not Vishnu Tattva. Well, one of them is Vishnu Tattva, and the other two are not Vishnu Tattva. And the Shaktivesha avatars largely are Jiva Tattva, although they're not all Jiva Tattva. So avatar doesn't mean necessarily God, but it means descending from directly from the spiritual world for a transcendental purpose. Or the powers gifted to those individuals are directly from the spiritual world. Thus the word avatar. So it's the next chapter is avatars. So over here, in chapter 2 of the process of devotional service, it's delineating the distinction between devotional service and other types of worship. And we run into some obstacle here when we're presenting Krishna consciousness, because people aren't accustomed to making that distinction. Or say it even stronger. They don't like to make that distinction. Hmm. Or say it stronger. They feel that it's broad-minded to not make that distinction. And those that make that distinction are narrow-minded. They don't understand what our religion is. Our religion is anything. Worship any nice person. Any nice person. Over there, over there, and over there. And that's our religion. So that discrimination capacity is being addressed here. What is the difference, and why is the difference preferred to worship Vishnu Tattva only? So, the first of the two verses, 25, we'll go back to the previous verse, because some of you weren't here yesterday morning. The previous verse makes this very simple to understand delineation why being situated in goodness is better than being situated in passion and ignorance. It's discussed in Bhagavad Gita, but a nice example is used that wood is better than earth, although wood is but transformation of earth. Smoke is better than wood, and fire is better than smoke. If you're so with the understanding, making this delineation, the understanding is the fire to be used in fire sacrifice is the desired objective. Specifically, satisfying Vishnu is the desired objective. So when you have a fire, you can have the fire yajna, and then you can, in that fire yajna, offer oblations and mantras, and you can have your formal sacrifice. Although mud is an earlier stage of that, you can't really have a fire yogi by pouring ghee into mud. So fire is the desired thing. Similarly, goodness is better, or among the three, it's best. Because from this position of goodness, one has the potential of entering into transcendental life, which has its implication that we're involved in transcendental life. We discussed this yesterday, which means it's incumbent upon us to be situated in modalities of goodness. I'm a devotee, and so I don't have to be clean. I'm a devotee, so I don't have to be truthful. I'm a devotee, so I don't have to be compassionate. I'm a devotee, so I don't have to study the scriptures. None of those statements are right. The devotee, therefore, I must do all these things. It's incumbent upon. So the indirect process that's also provided in the Vedas is this other one. So if why is there demigod worship if you can't derive this ultimate benefit from demigod worship? And the answer is some persons just aren't going to surrender to God. Surrender to Krishna. How many people are doing it? Sarvadharmam pratyajamam ekam sharanam braja. Just like a child. You ask a child to do something, and stubbornly they'll say, no. Not always, but. And sometimes they say no with an attitude. No. 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 So some persons surrender unto God. No. Or no. Okay. How about this? Those of you that have watched mothers work with children, there's another option of something that's better than the thing that's harmful. Then it's okay. So there's an indirect process that's meant for elevation to the modes of goodness. From the lower modes, these other forms of worship are to regulate the person whose mode is tamasic or rajasic to sattvic. That's the objective. And because the method of doing so comes from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there's some, although indirect, there's some submission through the codes of the Vedas by surrendering to the Vedic process. There's submission to the Supreme Lord, because the Vedas come from the Supreme Lord. So indirectly they can handle some people. Indirectly, I don't have to really acknowledge Narayan, just indirectly, I want this and I want that, and so I'll follow the Vedic codes to get this and that. So there's some submission to the Supreme Lord. But it's the purpose is elevation to the quality of goodness. When one becomes situated in the quality of goodness, there's the capacity for recognizing the value of transcendence. For one, mentioned already, there's some connection to the Vedas. So there's submission to Narayan. Two, there's requirement of a Brahman to perform the Vedic yagyas, whereby one can worship the various devas and do the various yagyas. So the second one is there is some contact with brahmanas, qualified, hopefully, brahmanas. Three, there's an understanding that there's some value in beyond my immediate enjoyments, there's longer term enjoyments, and ultimately there's after this life enjoyments. So then one starts to consider, as they say, hey, there's something beyond this life. There's something about the soul that endures beyond this life. It's not just about gratification now, like a child. Immediate gratification now. And if I don't get that gratification now, I'm going to throw a tantrum. You better give me what I want, because I'll make your life miserable. Give me what I want. Now. There's something beyond now. There's something after this life. There's a soul. I'm doing things to take care of now. I may be doing things to take care of after this life. Well, wait a minute. There's this soul that... What am I doing to take care of the needs of the soul? It's just the gradual elevation of consciousness, of consideration of beyond immediate into longer term, into ultimate, begins to awaken by that indirect process. So at some point, when one is given the opportunity for longer term benefit, ultimate benefit starts to make a little bit of sense. But by that time, one is situated in goodness by that indirect process, and then that person can very quickly, at least the potential is there, to very quickly move to the realm of transcendence. But then there's another process besides the indirect process. There's the direct process. And that is, from whatever position you're in, take up devotional service. We're not situated in goodness. That's okay, take up devotional service. Well, that's very merciful. Now, what about my qualities? Well, it's part of your responsibility. As you're taking up devotional service, trying to please the personality of Godhead, that you have to tidy up your qualities too. It's, so please understand I'm addressing our responsibility to become situated in qualities that are good. It's the same list that I gave before. To be kind, have compassion, be clean, be truthful, be, as the topic yesterday evening, be selfless in the service that you render. Be not selfish. I'll serve you as long as da-da-da-da-da. And if you don't do da-da-da-da-da, well, let me know when you're ready to do da-da-da-da-da. And I'll do it for a while, but I have my... So, not like that. That's not the quality of goodness. That's service in the mode of passion with an expectation of return. Without expectation of return, render service. And that's only going to be possible if pleasing Krishna is the objective of that service. Because if Krishna is not in the picture, that's what the message of these verses are. If Krishna is not in the picture, then it may be goodness, but it's tinged with passionate ignorance. I mean, that's putting it nicely. There's some consideration of the mode of goodness, but practically speaking, my main objective is, I want something. Back. I want something, it's to me. Something to you and something for me. So much for Krishna and so much for me. So much for you and so much for me. And I'm keeping score. And if it's not enough to me, then we got an issue with one another. So that's not selfless service. Or putting in Bhakti Siddhanta's language, his sadhu-like words, cutting right to the core, there is no love in this world. Lots of people are, you know, they have romance all the time. There is no love in this world. Meaning, when that condition of selfless service is there, that's not of this world. Where love of God exists, and because love of God exists, selfless service unto another exists. It's not of this world. It's your link to the spiritual world, and when you're linked to the spiritual world, you're in the spiritual world. The coverings of this world are gone. So just consider, I'll take that one point and do a little dissection here of that point. Here we are in Palatine, Illinois. But this Palatine, Illinois is part of the cloud of the material energy that's covering the vastness of the spiritual sky. So while we may identify with being in Palatine, Illinois, we're actually in the spiritual sky at the same time. And while we're in the spiritual sky at the same time, that spiritual sky is not disconnected from Krishna. It's the Brahma Jyoti emanating from Krishna. And the Brahma Jyoti that's emanating from Krishna is emanations from the transcendental body of Krishna. So we're situated in Krishna. So we can choose to be conscious of being situated in Krishna, or in a relationship with Krishna, or we can choose to identify with the Jyoti, or we can choose to identify with the Mahatattva, or we can choose to identify with Palatine, Illinois. Which one do you want? So the process of this second chapter is the process of devotional service, is making the choice. I want to be identified with, I want to identify myself with my relationship with Krishna. So worship of the transcendental Supreme Personality of Godhead makes that link, the bhakti yoga link, link through devotion with the Personality of Godhead. So while I may be physically in Palatine, Illinois, one can be in the world but not of the world. One can be in Krishna consciousness, in the spiritual world, even in this lifetime, even in this moment. Prabhupada taught us that we're making choices that every, the living entity has minute free will. We're marginal potency. We don't have unlimited free will. We have minute free will, and with that minute free will, we're making choices all the time. And the primary binary choice is Krishna or not. And if we choose Krishna, and consistently free will choice Krishna, yes, then that say yes to Krishna, if you recall from the Gitanagari retreat. If we're consistently saying yes to Krishna, that, and the activities that we perform are consistent with that consciousness of saying yes to Krishna, that's devotional. So we're connected with Krishna. And that means we're lifted out of this manifestation of material existence and all of its dualities and all the yucky stuff that goes with it. All the unwanted features of material existence through that linking process. And so, now back to part of the main message that's being given here, the what devotional service is not, there also has to be then, at least in forms of worship, saying not just no, but no thank you to other forms of worship.
with respect, thank you, but all respect, but no thank you. And similarly, with the process of worship, we can say no thank you to other things. You know, states of mind and behaviors and, you know, other unwanted things. Anger, lust, and jealousy. And so, in this verse, 26, bhajanti ki anasuyavaha. Those persons are certainly free from envy who worship Vishnu. So, the reverse of that is, as long as there's this attitude of envy towards the Supreme, I want to be the enjoyer. I want to enjoy. Why him? Sometimes him too. I'll be liberal. But me too. Why? I should be, you know, equal rights here. Come on. I'll share my toys and he should share his. Anasuyava. So, when one is non-envious, there's not an attitude towards Lord Vishnu. Such, those who are serious about liberation are certainly non-envious. And they respect all. In order to worship Vishnu, we don't disrespect others. Some people think that's what's going on. You Hare Krishnas, you're not respectful to others. Whatever, it's nice that you worship, that's nice. And what about this and what about that and that and that and that? What happened? So it's a little bit like Prabhupada describes this, that when someone is taking up devotional service, we've been involved, there's an immaturity factor that goes on. We've been involved with material energy for so long that when you try to get out of that contaminated association, there may be a tendency in the beginning to be, you know, a little harsh with that stuff that you were involved with. It gets away from you. And you get away from it. And an example that Prabhupada gives is with a seedling that you plant in your garden, a small tree or something, you put a fence around it. Because you don't want creatures and people and things, because it's very young and tender. So a young and tender plant or creeper, you give some protection to it that you, once the tree is grown, you know, you don't have to do that. Fully matured tree that you don't, it can stand on its own. But in the beginning stage, there's some special care. And so same, is it just a natural mechanism that in the beginning, one may be, you know, a little strong about not doing certain things and being in certain environments and so on. And let's say within a temple, a bhakta leader is a person who's the authority, that's very, very caring and nurturing kind of person, looks after a new devotee, and it's best if other devotees in the temple don't instruct that person. It gets too confusing. You get 10 different people telling you different things all the time because you're a new person. They feel they got to tell you all these things. And it's overload. It's just too much. So if we have a policy in temples where there's a bhakta leader and there's a bhakta. If you see the bhakta doing something that's not appropriate, you tell the bhakta leader. And at the right time, the right circumstance, and the right mode of communication, the bhakta leader makes sure that the new bhakta understands. This is, you know, this isn't so good, better like this. And slowly, slowly, training can go on. That's nice. Same in our, in a congregational situation. If there are persons who we have, let's say one person has a particularly strong relationship with a particular newer person. So it's good for the preachers in the community to understand, to communicate regularly. You know, so-and-so is helping, they're working. The primary relationship is with this devotee, with that couple over there. So any information about or instruction for or concern for those persons primarily should go through that, particularly instructions, should go through that channel. Friendship should be there in all cases. For I can't talk to them because they're being mentored by somebody else. But you respect that relationship. So with demigod worship, perhaps in the beginning, or not only demigod worship, other, let's say someone comes from a Christian background, there may be some get down on the Christians talk. But just like to separate. But in a mature stage, the appreciation is there's a purpose for this particular worship or that particular theology or something. It's there because it satisfies, God has created because it satisfies a need for certain people in certain stages. That's good. And what Prabhupada would do in those circumstances, say particularly with other religions, is he would encourage them that they follow what they're supposed to follow. He would shake the faith of those persons. You shouldn't worship like that, you should worship like us. Rather, your scriptures say you should do like this. Why? You should do like this. The idea behind demigod worship, it should come to the quality of goodness. Because in the quality of goodness, then the appreciation of transcendence is enhanced. But there's not disrespect of the worshiper, not disrespect of the object of worship, not disrespect of the process of worship. It's just something that you don't take part in. With no disrespect, with due respect, we don't take part in that worship. Because the interest is in the ultimate attainment. The message of Srimad Bhagavatam is paradharma. It's a manual of how to achieve the ultimate objective. And so the distinction between that which doesn't give the ultimate objective is being made. What devotional service is not. And the purpose of devotional service is not served by that other form of worship. Just like some people say, it's nice that you worship Krishna, and even primarily worship Krishna. That's okay. But why not other things? Because the not other things, it doesn't deliver the ultimate good. I'll give one practical example of this from scripture, and then see if there's some discussion. Those of you that, maybe two, those of you that have studied Nectar of Devotion, some of you have studied Nectar Devotion carefully. There are 64 items of devotional service. Specifically, it's in seva, things that are that you can do that enhance worship of the deity. Specifically, it's in relation to deity worship. 64 items. It's a lot, but it's not overwhelming. And one of those items is worship of Ganesh. So, the devotees in the early stage of our Krishna consciousness movement, red nectar devotion, and thought, oh, we should be worshipping Ganesh. Or there's some things that say, you know, what color of cloth you shouldn't wear when coming before the deity. Oh, especially ladies, I shouldn't wear saris of this color, that color. So Prabhupada was asked about these things. Why in Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami says that we should worship Ganesh, but you haven't introduced worship of Ganesh, so can you explain? And Prabhupada explained that when one is pure in heart, one can worship Ganesh for the removal of obstacles for attaining unalloyed devotion at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. But in your stage, you have so many material desires, you go to Ganesh, and you'll get the fulfillment of those material desires, which will be an obstacle for you on the path of attaining pure devotional service. Right? Worship of Ganesh is not there. But rather, worship of Lord Nisringadev is there. If there's some obstacle that's been placed in my path from some imperfection in my worship of the deity, this worship of Lord Nisringadev, so after every arti, and it's, in ISKCON it's become the ritual that after every kirtan, or at least many kirtans, for sure after arti, after worship of the deity, this prayer to Lord Nisringadev is therefore removing from our hearts any impurity that may have come from any source, particularly from the worship of the deity. Any mistake that may have been made, any offense that may have been made, Lord Nisringadev, please remove this from my heart and clear the path for achieving unalloyed devotion for the personality of Godhead. But there are some places in our amongst the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu where in their writings they offer prayers to Ganesh. It's part of our Vaishnava Tantra if one is very elevated, or part of the ritual. It's right there in Rupa Goswami's teaching, but it's for the devotional purpose only. So we don't do those things. The injunctions of scriptures require very careful guidance under the direction of the spiritual master. How do we apply these things? And how do we not apply these things? So I hope nobody's offended, but out of sentiment, sometimes, because it's just traditional or something like that, devotees will put a little image of Ganesh on their altar. And it's not the training that Prabhupada has given us, and for the reasons I've just mentioned. It's not bad or wrong, it's not what's going to maximize, at our stage of devotional service, achieving the ultimate good that's being described here in these verses of the Bhagavatam. We worship the personal, we worship Vishnu, Tattva. You know, one of the counter arguments is, well, these personalities, they're devotees of the Lord too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I see some other images on your altar that's not Vishnu, Tattva. Mm-hmm. So, but those persons whose images are on the altar, their mandate is to deliver the message of pure devotion only. That's their service, that's their function. And the others who are representatives of the Lord, they have other functions. Dispensing the necessities of life for those who want to ensure that they have their necessities of life. So this is a nice, this last comment is, Prabhupada's an appreciation of what the Bhagavatam is. The Bhagavatam is the graduate study of the message of Bhagavad Gita. Or Bhagavad Gita's ABCs and the Bhagavatam is grammar, composition. So the message of Bhagavad Gita is amplified and explained more completely and in greater detail in the Bhagavatam. They're companion literatures. It's not a different message. Just the message of the Bhagavatam expands more fully, explains things that are within Bhagavad Gita. So it's good to study carefully Bhagavad Gita, and then in course of time, study Srimad Bhagavatam very thoroughly, comprehensively. And when you do that, you'll appreciate more of what Bhagavad Gita is saying, and how Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita. And you'll also appreciate the beauty of the Bhagavatam. It's taking this core message over here and explaining it so nicely. With such beautiful poetry and imagery and clarity. The study of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam complement one another very nicely. Let's see if there's any discussion on this topic here.
Maharaj, about the demigods, we know that there are some demigods who are pure devotees of the Lord, like Yamaraj and Lord Shiva, the very exalted Vaishnavas. But from what I understand, there are 33 million demigods, and I was just curious to know, are they all situated in, do they know what is what with the spiritual conception? Are they doing their duties in pure devotional service, or are they also prone to material condition?
Well, I think you give some examples. What about Indra? Mm-hmm. Varuna. It wasn't Varuna, it was Varuna's agent. Kidnapped Nanda Maharaj. Mm-hmm. Now Varuna is a devotee. When Krishna came to reclaim his father, Varuna worshipped him. And was full of apology and got on the case of that person who kidnapped Nanda. So, but they're mixed in their devotion. And the position of the two that you mentioned, Lord Shiva is not in that category of the 33 million administrative demigods. He's a guna avatar. And the devatas, their function is they administer the government, the affairs of necessities, the wind, the water, the air, the light, the health and wealth and so on. Lord Shiva isn't in that position, although when not always, but pretty consistently, Prabhupada includes Lord Shiva as the demigod, such as demigods, but specifically the 33 million, that's the administrators that dispense things. In a routine fashion. They maintain the affairs of the governance of the universe. Lord Shiva just has this kind of carte blanche capacity. He can move through any department and do what he likes. Does that take care of your question?
I don't know. Maharaj, a hypothetical question probably, but if a devotee is in mode of goodness and he wants to proceed to Krishna...
Is or is not?
It is.
The devotee is in the mode of goodness and wants to proceed to Krishna.
Yeah, versus a person who is not practicing devotional service but in mode of goodness and gets in contact with devotional service. Is there going to be any difference in how they make progress?
There's always going to be difference. What specifically do you mean?
Like, is there a difference in reaching to mode of goodness by a devotional path versus a non-devotional path?
Your premise is one who... let's go back. Of the two, there's two persons. One who is in the mode of goodness and is practicing devotional service. One who is not.
Or is there any difference between the achievement one gets if one comes to mode of goodness via devotional path versus... not a devotional path and then gets devotional service.
Yeah, one's more direct and swift and the other is more indirect and slow.
Right, but after...
The after effect? No. No. Prabhupada explained, saying the same thing in a different way. There are three kinds of perfection. Kripa Siddhi, Sadhana Siddhi, and Nitya Siddhi, or Nitya Siddha. But when one is at the platform of Siddha, it's Siddha. Hmm. One doesn't take an inventory and say, okay, all of you as Nitya Siddhas over there, Sadhana Siddhas over there. There's not a distinction. So the quality, achieving the quality of goodness, and then devotional service, or achieving devotional service and then the qualities of goodness come, when perfection is there, it's perfection. It just may be harder if one who is in the position of goodness but not in pure devotion to come to pure devotion. I may be very attached to that which has brought me this position of goodness. We find that. And on the other hand, persons who are who have strayed from some strict path, but you know are finding the harsh feature of the material nature, they may more readily take to so in distress they may more readily take to devotional service than they're comfortably situated, like Nalakuvir and Manigriva. So Narada removed them completely from their favorable position, materially auspicious position, to a deprived position. So when persons are deprived, there's some advantages. There's some disadvantages. There's some disadvantages in being well situated. As Queen Kunti indicates, one cannot feelingly take shelter, call out the names of the Lord and take shelter of the Lord. Complacency. Sense of contentedness. I'm very comfortable. Yes, I'll give a little charity, see you later. Good cause. But not... It's special when someone is very well situated and they're very strong in their sadhana, their intense devotion to the personality of Godhead. Like when we, for example, we read the qualities of Maharaj Ambarish. He had everything. But to him it meant nothing other than as a facility to serve Krishna, but wasn't an object of enjoyment. All of his immense wealth and influence and all of the opulence that comes from a perfectly mode of goodness situated person. Quite often we find persons who have the opulences that are born of the mode of goodness are very contented in those opulences. They're enjoying their position. They're pious. So, you know, being a demigod is more attractive to a materialist than being a pure devotee. Or being going to the heavenly planets is more attractive to many people than to the spiritual world. And most people don't make a distinction between the two. Not just in India or in the East, around the world. Attaining heaven is not made, there's not a distinction between that and the kingdom of God, although there is a distinction. Anyway. But once that stage of perfection is achieved, there's not, it's perfection.
I guess my question was, like there seems to be more anarthas which a person in mode of goodness coming from non-devotional path would have to encounter than just like Bhagavatam says.
It's not more anarthas. This is the same mountain. Just how to cross the mountain. The likelihood of a person through many lifetimes consistently and flawlessly following the path of gradual elevation, there's a lot less likelihood of that. Lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime staying on that path and flawlessly executing that path, especially in this age of Kali, not very likely. Not that they're going to get good guidance lifetime after lifetime and execute and keep the goal in mind. Not likely. But it's the same. Your proposal is the amount of anarthas is not less. It's just how you're going to deal with it. Even from a logical point of view, we'll just speak of a practical point of view. It's not logical. Where is it practical? Where are the brahmanas that can guide one and that have the understanding and can take one in an indirect path, knowing what the direct, what the ultimate goal of the indirect path is, and effectively do it? And that someone's going to follow. And when they have the opportunity, they'll take it. It's just... it's not happening. It's a theoretical construct that ain't happening. But even theoretically, it's more difficult. It's not, you know, the indirect path Krishna doesn't recommend. The direct path Krishna recommends. And our acharyas don't recommend, and Bhagavatam doesn't recommend. If you want to make a case for recommending, you're going to have a hard time convincing me. It's there for those who won't. And it's and its effectiveness is enormously diminished in this age of Kali. Practically speaking, not possible. Kalo nascheva, nascheva, nascheva. Gatir Anyata. Okay, I'm convinced.
Related question I had is when Bhagavatam says that even those impersonalists who have attained their impersonal liberation, they still have avishuddha buddhi. So, what kind of contamination is there? Because
what kind of contamination is where? In a person who has, they think they have achieved liberation. Well, that's easy.
They're not sure
that it's just in their mind. I'm liberated. Have you met persons that say that they're God? I've met many persons. And they're very liberal. You're God too. What's that? It's in their mind. Okay, tell you what, this god is going to punch that god right in the schnozzle. Pow! How'd you like that? I'm God, it's okay. You're God, you can't be hurt.
The course is referring not to like perfect impersonalists.
Huh?
That verse is not referring to perfected impersonalists.
They're thinking themselves, so they can the imperfection is thinking of themselves to be the supreme. So what is that condition? Supposing there's someone that they've actually attained. It's not what analyze this. Is it Brahman realization or thinking that they are Brahman realized? That's your question?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say, if it's they are Brahman realized, what is the contamination? It's limitation more than contamination. It's the attitude of rebellion from the personality of Godhead that's the contamination, as well as an imperfection, or incomplete realization. I am Brahman. Okay, what's Krishna? Krishna is Brahman. And I am Krishna. Because all there is Brahman. There's not differentiation. All there is Brahman. What is Krishna? Krishna is Brahman. Ask them, what does the impersonal say? A rarefied condition of goodness. It's offensive. It's contamination.
So how can one have contamination and not have a covering? Because if they are in Brahman Jyoti, they don't have a covering.
Well, my understanding is this. I've been through this in Nectar Devotion classes where we analyze this very deeply. It's not the Brahman realized persons don't specifically have a bad attitude towards Krishna. That's a covering. That then they're not entitled. But if they don't, they just have a misconception. They don't have a clear, proper conception of Krishna as Parabrahman, as the personality of Godhead. They don't have that conception. But what's very prominent is their identification with Brahman, and their differentiating themselves from material modes of nature. So such persons enter that position. So it's not with an attitude. Whereas, like the Brahma body is superior to the Maya body. The Maya body has an attitude. And the Brahma body just identifies with Brahma. So what's the impurity? And you're going through this, the college kind of argument. You know what I mean? To deal with college students. It's not, if there's contamination, then how they can enter, how they don't have covering. If there's contamination, what's the contamination? So it's language. It's an imperfect understanding, a limited understanding of the Supreme. But there's the word avishuddha buddhi. So they don't have a clear understanding. They have a proper, and therefore they've not taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, and therefore they fall down. Yes.
Maharaj, is complacency due to pride or laziness or carelessness?
All of the above. All of the above. I mean, you could go through it, but it's ego-centered, and I've got what I want. my reason for doing something is I want. But I got what I want, so at least for the moment I think I have what I want, until I realize, wait a minute, I'm feeling insufficiency, so I want something. Something's missing. So then I'll do something. In that section that I was reading from yesterday, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is explaining this indifference, which is complacency. So it's to a degree it's material. I'm feeling materially comfortable, which is just a relative thing. I'm not feeling pinched by the discomfort of the pangs of material existence. There's a lull. So, complacency. But another may be, in the positive side, I'm feeling a sense of contentedness with my situation, and so it's like the example of nectar of devotion, that for the materialist, they work very hard for 5 days, but they want their 2 days vacation. Or they take their vacation, and when the vacation is over, they're ready, I'm bored, I want to go back to work. Or that which is familiar with me. So, accepting and rejecting is the idea. Sankalpa, vikalpa. And complacency is, I've taken shelter of the personality of Godhead, and so those motivators, having been fulfilled, I now become complacent. But, pride in the list is also there. I'm enjoying the fruits of my pious endeavors. Whereas the position of devotional, in contrast, the position of devotional service is it doesn't end. The surrendering to Krishna doesn't end. The service unto Krishna doesn't end. And the joy that comes from being in connection with Krishna doesn't end. But complacency is my material. It's a material position, and pride in that position, etc. Laziness for the ultimate objective is also. Okay. Yes.
I have two questions. One is regarding free will. You said jivas have minute, limited free will. So how do I understand the word limited? Does it mean that we have choice to make only certain decisions and certain other decisions are made by somebody else?
No. Think of it like this. Like a cow that has a rope around the cow's neck. Or here in America, it's dogs, but, cows are making it. So it can be a long rope or a short rope or somewhere in between. They got a rope. Because they have a master. Someone cares for the cow. So with a longer rope, the cow can cover a greater radius. In a shorter rope, lesser radius. But in both cases, free will, depending upon some choices that we make, the mode of goodness choices allow us more freedom. Although it looks like more restriction. We have greater freedom. And in the taking shelter of Krishna position, it's an invisible rope. It's the rope of love. we will not go outside of Krishna's will by the proper use of our free will. So we're controlled by the rope of love. And that's the maximum extent of our free will. It's the choosing, saying yes to Krishna. If we say no to Krishna, then we got a rope, a visible one. Here it is. And so many restrictions that are imposed upon us because we're saying no. So the good citizen has the invisible rope. They follow the laws of the state. The bad citizen says no to the laws of state and they're put in jail, or solitary confinement, or in a padded cell. So the range of free will is primarily these. It's limited. I can't. Okay, I've got free will. I'll be Krishna. Or I was explaining to some kids in Houston, Texas, about the changing bodies diorama. I said, oh, they were drinking their beer, looking at the changing bodies. I said, okay. Turned to his friend and said, well, I'm going to put in my requisition for a body that, and I'm going to repeat what they said. I want ones like that, like that, like that, like that. And off they went. So, you know, because I want one like that, and that, and that, doesn't mean, you know, we don't have the, it's not in our free will capacity to make that decision. We're bound by the laws of karma and the laws of internal nature, the modes of nature and the laws of karma. We're bound by them. The three ropes. But, so if I choose, the more I choose in harmony with Krishna's will, the longer the rope. And when it's fully, it's the maximum rope. But it's still not unlimited free will. The other question?
The other question is regarding demigod worship. I'm going to make it a two-part question. First one is... you said devotees who have surrendered to Krishna respect other demigods, but they do not worship them. I want some practical advice. If I'm put in a circumstance where I'm in a temple where there are a lot of altars of all the other demigods, how do I behave?
Respectfully.
To the demigods or to the
Krishna? Respectfully. Why not? There's an ant in your path. What are you going to do? Just an ant. Respectfully. According to position. And the other part?
The second part was, you said, worshipping the demigods, when somebody else asked the question, you said, worshipping the demigods. Well, we do not worship the demigods because they satisfy our material desires. So what if I go in front of a demigod and ask for, you know, ask to increase my surrender to Krishna, or...
Well, are they empowered and gifted to give that? They have specific powers to do other things. They're devotees. They're mixed devotees, but they're devotees. I've never had anyone ask that question. having such a thought, there's certainly no harm. Whether they're able to dispense like that is another thing. Maybe give their blessings that becomes possible or something like that. better to, just thinking about it, better to have such a desire than blank, because blank then means other desires are also in the heart, if not expressed. Oh, that's nice.
Same, just follow up on the same question.
Okay.
So if I go to the temple of Lord Shiva, can I ask Lord Shiva to increase my faith in?
Sure.
He has the power.
He has. Amongst the servants of, amongst the Vaishnavas, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Shiva is the best. Vaishnavanamita Shambhu. Of course, there's many best. But he's identified there as best. And he has his own disciplic succession where he bestows love of God. He certainly, he has and he can give. That's very nice. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but to speak of ourselves, he would, he on occasion visited temples of Lord Shiva. And one can be sure that the prayers of Mahaprabhu weren't for something material, but for glorifications of the Supreme Lord and the process of pure devotion to serve Him. Okay. Yeah?
So Maharaj, when this is a little bit off the demigod topic,
okay.
When we speak to like people of other practice, of other traditions, like Christians or Muslims or Jains or whatever they are, and as you said, Prabhupada always values their faith that they come with, and whatever they're willing to do in their relationship development with their supreme goal. So, is it better for us, or let's say my personal examples? I often feel like, you know, if I hear some misconceptions, that right away there should be some correction there. Is it better to overlook some misconception in order to nurture whatever faith is there in their path?
It's not for that reason. It may be, it depends on the relationship and, you know, the person and the circumstance more than like a blanket principle. Because if they have a misconception, while you don't want to disturb their faith, at the same time, to redirect a misconception to a proper conception would be a nice service. But then, not only people of other faiths, there may be, you know, there may be circumstances where we're not going to address every single circumstance, even in the company of devotees, that, you know, there's something that needs to be corrected. We have to consider the time, place, and circumstance. Should we, how should we, if we should, etc. The danger of saying nothing is the fostering of a relationship, I'm okay, you're okay. Which is, you know, while there's value in interfaith dialogue and that kind of thing, there's a risk in it also. At least this much, if you could go to the place where you're offering a prayer to Prabhupada of gratitude for rescuing me from misconceptions, the ocean of misconceptions. And then another prayer to Prabhupada, please give me the intelligence how I might address this person's misconception. in a proper mood, in the proper way. And so, at least in your consciousness, you're not being influenced by the misconception, and you're in the right mood of acting in relation to this person. Quite often, that space is, we don't enter that space. We just react. We either say nothing in a reaction, or say something in a reaction, rather than, you know, being Krishna conscious. So I'd recommend being Krishna conscious, and then depending upon the circumstance and how Krishna inspires you. If you go to that Krishna conscious place and you're practiced at being in that Krishna conscious place, new circumstances become ever fresh and different, and Krishna will inspire different things at different times depending upon the circumstance. And it's pretty amazing how that, and wonderful how that works. So that's nicer than just, the instruction is, don't say anything. Or the instruction is, correct the misconception. Rather, my recommendation is, be Krishna conscious and consider the circumstance and what indication Krishna gives to you, whether to correct or to let it go. Because then, at least, you're protected and you're in a position of purity of consciousness. And then that will have its impact if you say nothing. And that will have its impact if you say something. As opposed to saying something, saying nothing without being in the right consciousness.
When you sit down, if a person is taking guidance from some other person, and if that person comes and asks for instruction, we should just say, we should first inquire, or we can just give a general instruction, like for example chanting.
Oh, that's easy. Give me a harder one. If it's something practical, Sachi Kumar, I've got this situation where I don't know if I should, let my mother know that I'm chanting 16 rounds and I'm offering all my food, and should I go ahead and disclose that, or you don't know the situation, and you don't know how the person is guiding them. You don't want them to play one against the other and get bewildered or any of that. So but don't say nothing. You inquire, and you take interest in their situation. You say, this is a real, real serious decision you're making. Why don't you, I'm sure that the person who's guiding you has a deeper understanding of your situation. Why don't you inquire from them? I really support you for making this very sincere and sensitive consideration, rather than just, you support the relationship while taking personal interest in the individual. But if it's general things like chanting, that's different.
Ask people to take up Krishna consciousness for material benefit, if I go and tell them they have some problems and they just come and tell me stuff, and I'm like, okay, why don't you chant Krishna, you might get this or whatever, what do you ask for? Is that the right So then they will pray in that mind, they will be praying God for that thing, not for their room.
That's possible. Whether they'll do that or not is another thing. And it depends on the situation.
Yeah.
And the relationship you have with that person. You may want to go in the direction of, you know, just showing concern for the thing that they're struggling with. And then indicate, you know, this is a clear signal that being in the material condition of life is not a happy situation. There's some lesson in all of this. Is there another situation? Is there the situation, a spiritual position, spiritual situation? Even just throwing it out. Let them ask, well, what do you mean by that? Well, there is an alternative. Okay, well, I'm just absorbed in this situation. I don't care about the alternative. I'll worry about that later. Anyway, so but there's not a harm in speaking like that. There's a verse in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Akama sarvakamova moksha kama udaradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. If someone goes to Krishna not with tivra bhakti but just casual, I got a problem, I'll go to Krishna. I mean, people do this all the time. I've got an exam coming, I'll go worship. You got a health problem, I'll go pray to God. And then the health problem, the exam's over, and see you later, Krishna. So if there's some benefit, there's not harm. But if the circumstance permits, try to help the person understand something more deep. Okay, I think we should end. Thank you very much. Shiva Prabhupada.
Jai. Guru Vishnu Pad Maharaj ki.
Jai.